Well, good afternoon. You guys switched to Zoom, huh?
Yeah, we did.
We don't care about security.
Well, hey, at our age, what's just here, you know? They've already got it all already, you know?
Yeah, probably more than we can even imagine.
I'm sure, you know. Having worked in database structures for Intel up there years ago, it's like, it's amazing. I mean, this was back in the late 80s and 90s. It's like, even then they had more information than civilized.
Yeah, and that's when you add Google and to the equation, they know everything.
And people without enough common sense to know that you really shouldn't be putting all that stuff out there, you know? So, but one day our young people will say, gosh, why did I do that?
You know? Well, I'm going to talk about a lot of complaints about the Public Disclosure Commission, all the information we have to provide. And there's a history of electeds and government employees being targeted based on that information. So, anyway.
Oh, yeah, well, some public officials actually put their own foot in it by doing some rather absurd, you know, personal shots.
A member of the legislature there, and he says that the Public Disclosure Commission staff has gone way beyond what the law calls for. So that's going to be looked at. Hey, let's get started here. Welcome to the Clallam County Board of Commissioners meeting of July the 27th, 2020, a virtual meeting. So we'll call this meeting to order. The first item is approval. By the way, is Jim on?
Yes, I'm on.
You're on? Good. Okay, we call this meeting to order. First is the approval of the consent agenda. We've got minutes from the July 13th, 2020 meeting and claim vouchers from July 13th through July 20th.
Yeah, Will, on that one, the payroll vouchers was removed from that consent agenda. It wasn't ready, so that one item is out of it and will be presented at a future meeting.
Okay, what happened to everybody here? There we go. Okay, good. We'll catch that one up later then. So do I have a motion on the consent agenda?
Yep, if there are any other questions, I move that we approve the consent agenda, which includes the item A, the minutes from July 13th, 2020 meeting, and the claim voucher item B from July 13th through the 20th, and omitting item C, the payroll vouchers.
I don't have an item C on my agenda.
Oh, yeah, I've got it on my agenda.
Okay, yeah.
I noticed we got a note afterwards to delete that. So.
Okay, so it has been version I have has been revised. Okay, do we have a second?
Yeah, I don't have any discussion, so I'll second it.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda for July 27, 2020. All those in favor?
Aye.
Okay, good. Agenda revisions. Anything, Doug?
Yeah, under the business items, Tyler had included the Clallam 10-year utility resource plan actually stapled on the back of his item B, which was a resolution authorizing disposal of surplus renewable energy credits. So if we could make that a separate item, item C, call it Clallam 10-year utility resource plan.
Okay. That's the way it appears on my agenda, so that's good. Anything from the board? Oops, go ahead.
Yeah, like what my agenda's just like yours there.
Yeah, T updated the agenda, but I think the public didn't see that update yet.
Okay, good.
I have a question about the agenda. The BOC package had the strategic plan at the bottom of it. I don't see that on here as a discussion item. What are you going to... What are we going to do with it being on there? I mean, what's our
The strategic plan comes during the staff reports. Okay. It's item C. It's the KPIs, the key performance indicators for each of the.
Okay, good. All right, fine. I don't have revision then.
Okay. Let me just say this. I've been told this is going to be a long meeting, especially that item C under staff reports for the KPIs. What I propose to do is to, if we get to a good breaking point there, cut this off at about 4 o'clock, and then we can continue it at our next meeting. Any objection to that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, no, that should be fine.
Okay, our next item is comments from the public, and Sean, you're going to handle that, right?
Yes, sir. If anybody has a comment they would like to make at this time, please give me your first name and we'll go in the order that I receive them.
Richard.
Christine.
Anybody else?
Yeah, Jim Schuneman. Jim Schuneman.
Okay. Okay, well, first up, I have Richard.
Okay, how do you read me?
Lima Charlie, Richard, Lima Charlie.
All right. So I'm going to briefly go back to the last meeting because I noted that, Will, you were really disappointed that we weren't there for public comments. So I'll try to make up for it now, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay. So last meeting, my public comment was intended to be relative to the Tier 1 status and why I've been reading and hearing that possibly Tier 1 utilities were subsidizing others. And in as much as I wasn't able to get connected, I sent that as an email, and Sean Worthington replied promptly and gave me a good course in Tier 1, Tier 2, and all manner of things related to that. And so I appreciate that, Sean. That was a good job on your part. I still am not entirely clear why there is word out there that Tier 1 is subsidizing, or where that came from, I guess. What caused that kind of discussion to occur? So that's my question today, what's the source of that kind of discussion? And other than that, that's all I have for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Who's next up?
Next is Christine. You're muted, Christine.
Sorry about that. That doesn't happen often. In addition to the email that I sent out yesterday that I hope that we can just get, you know, short answers to, just for curiosity mostly, and as we concern. And the other thing I have is a question regarding the name of the consulting firm that was hired to evaluate resource adequacy that you mentioned last week, Purser. Commissioner Purser, I was never able to find that, locate that, unless it is the one that's on the document that you also mentioned.
I think its name is Western Energy, but don't take that to the bank. I'm not sure. I'm right off hand. I don't recall.
Yeah, because I was wanting to look out for that report to see when it's released or if it's already released. And also, are we going to have an update on the Forks Operations Building? At one time, we had briefly, this was back in January, when we had when we were still meeting, I talked with John Purvis, and about perhaps seeing if that would be suitable for community solar or an EV station like we did at the one in Squims. And so, anyway, I just wondered if anything is moved forward on that or if there's any report on that. And maybe we can add it to a future PUD meeting. And my last question is, what is the plan for our representation for our PUD during the next 2020 rate case negotiations? since we're no longer a part of PPC, what are we going to do? Who's going to go to the negotiation table for us, with us?
Okay, Christine, I can answer some of that. I'm not answered, but I can tell you. We can go ahead. Tyler will probably be answering most of your questions when he comes to his part on the item B on the disposal of renewables, or RECs, I'm sorry.
Oh, great. Okay.
We can give you an update on Forks in the next meeting or so, and we can also address the 2028 that you mentioned, too.
Okay. Well, actually, it's the next rate case, not the 2028 so much. I was just concerned about what was going to happen in the near future, you know.
Okay. All right. That's great. Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, next is Jim.
Yes. Hi. I just have some questions again about what Tyler's going to be talking about. The authorization of the disposal of surplus energy credits, renewable energy credits. I'd like to know about that. I assume he's going to talk about the history of it, why it was purchased, and why U.S. Geothermal out of, Nevada, that there was credits purchased for them as opposed to developing community solar or renewable or solar projects here in the Collin County area, and would that be applicable for this sort of, you know, renewable energy credits? And the second thing is, how were they acquired? Were they bought? And if they were bought, you know, what is their current value at this point? So those are my questions in relation to that.
Okay, this is Doug again. Tyler will probably hit on most of those during his presentation. And at the end, if you don't have any or if they're not answered, you can ask something that wasn't answered anyway. But what you're saying should be able to be covered during the presentation.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I had no others, Will.
Okay. Well, good. Thanks for those questions. Our next item is business items, of course, and the first one is a recommendation memo to purchase composite poles, Sourcewell contract number 121218-WES. That's John Purvis. John?
Yes, Commissioners. I draw your attention to a memo in your board package, a recommendation memo for the procurement of various sizes of composite poles. And when I say composite poles, these are essentially fiberglass poles of various sizes. This is for the airport to Oak Street transmission rebuild project, now scheduled for construction next year. We're proceeding with the order of poles to ensure we have them in time for construction. One of the manufacturers have lead times now going out close to 35 weeks. We want to make sure that we have them on hand and they're ready to go for the project. RS poles or composite poles are one of three vendor or manufacturers of poles that we buy our transmission poles from. We used to have a single supplier. Now we have three. And about 13 years ago, actually a little more than 13 years ago, for our transmission poles, we transitioned to composite poles as being lower cost life cycle due to their longevity and the ease of handling when you get to very large pole sizes. Staff requests that the commission approve recommendation memo, reference Sourcewell contract number 121218-WES, to purchase 31 composite poles of various sizes and necessary accessories for the airport substation to Oak Street rebuild in the amount of $238,254.52.
John, how much are these poles? There's 31 of them for $240,000.
Yes, they're averaging approximately $7,500 per pole. The sizes primarily are 70 and 75 foot poles. We do have a couple of 80 and 85 foot structures for a creek crossing, but the average cost of these poles are close to $7,500, which is not too far off from Western Red Cedar poles when you get to the very large sizes. For fiberglass poles, for the large sizes, they're very competitive with the wood pole cost simply because of availability for Western Red Cedar, which is what we use for wood poles.
And, John, I think you, at one point, we did a life cycle cost comparing these poles to cedar poles. They came out very favorable.
Well, yes. Our under our pole test and treat program, we believe that we're getting a pole life of 50 to 55 years out of our wood poles. And there's no reason, since they developed UV-stabilized composite poles, that barring major impact with tree, vehicle, or otherwise, these poles should last well over 80 years. And the price difference I want to emphasize between wood and fiberglass for the very large poles are not that different. Now, we still use wood distribution poles in the 45-foot size because you do pay a premium for fiberglass, plus they tend to be exposed to elements a little bit more due to narrower maintenance of right-of-ways close to roads, and they can be a challenge to fix in a case of damage. So as long as the right-of-ways are maintained clear, such as the really wide transmission right-of-ways, fiberglass poles are more cost-effective life cycle costs.
And did Sourcewell look at all three vendors and get a quote from them?
We don't go into details of what they did, but we did get a tentative quote from another manufacturer with an extremely long lead time. We're told that one of the manufacturers are shipping poles almost exclusively to, you would guess, California. The other supplier is not. So we don't go into specific details because that's handled by Sourcewell, and we don't make the distinction when we go through Sourcewell to handle the poles. But we considered whether we were going to use Sourcewell or whether we were going to bid this project. We were looking at past history on deliveries as part of the math to determine how to proceed, and we elected to go with Sourcewell because we knew we could get good lead time and comply with all state laws for soliciting poles.
Okay, other questions?
So 70 feet is the shortest composite pole we buy, right?
Generally so. No, we do buy 65-foot transmission poles, and we even buy fiberglass guy-step poles as short as 40 feet. For this project, the bulk or the majority of the poles are 70 and 75-foot poles. There are a couple 65-foot poles and I believe a 60-foot pole, as well as a couple of guy-step poles.
Oh, okay.
The majority of the poles tend to be 70 and 75 foot poles, and that's true for a 115 kV system.
Okay. Well, I move that we accept the staff request for the commission to approve recommendation memo Sourcewell contract 121218-WES to purchase 31 composite poles of various sizes and necessary accessories for the airport substation to Oak Street rebuild. The amount of the contract is $238,254.52.
I'll second that.
It's been moved and seconded to accept staff's recommendation to purchase from Sourcewell. What's the full name of this company? Oh, Sourcewell is our purchasing agreement. Okay. Contract number 121218-WES for 31 composite poles of various size and necessary accessories for the airport substation to Oak Street rebuild. The amount of the contract is $238,254.52. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, good. Thank you. Next item is Resolution 2178, authorizing the disposal of surplus renewable energy credits. Is Tyler on?
Yes. Hey, Will, real quick, as mentioned in the public comment, we did get an email over the weekend with some questions regarding the resolution that Tyler's about to present. If you don't mind, I'm going to have him go over those questions and answer them, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's perfectly fine.
Okay. Go ahead, Tyler.
Thank you, Sean. So one of the questions asked the disposal or how do we dispose of surplus RECs? Well, RECs are intangible property. They are the attributes to electricity. So basically they're the renewable portion of the electricity that you receive. Since it is an item of value, we dispose or move them from our books in a transaction, value for value. So we'll sell these to a broker, and then he will find somebody on the market that that may need some. Apple, Facebook, Microsoft have all contributed to 100% renewable energy resources, and when they buy these RECs, it will replace, one REC replaces 1,000 megawatt or 1,000 kilowatt hours of energy. And another question was, why are 7,794 RECs ineligible? These RECs are of a 2018 vintage. The EIA, Energy Independence Act, requires that for compliance, we can use the vintage of the prior year, the current year, or the next year to meet that compliance year. And so far, we have met 2018 and 2019 requirements, both of those being 9% of our load. Okay, what changed since the time RECs were required or acquired? The contract was entered into in 2009, and based on a 2008 load forecast that's 10 years old now, we forecasted that we'd have load growth, and it just never really materialized. The EIA requires that we purchase contracts ahead of compliance, so we don't really know how much we need, we have to forecast out. And let's see, will the financial loss be more than the cost to acquire the RECs? Yes, the older the REC gets, the less valuable it is. And we purchased these RECs at $17. The market price I've seen for Washington compliant wind RECs are $2.15 a piece, but one of the brokers offered up to $3 per REC. Another question was, do we have a contract for the purchase of these RECs? And we do not at this time. We have to surplus them first, and then we are eligible to sell them. But until then, we it's too early to have a contract. And Snohomish PUD acted in a different route. While they were required to retire 9% of the load, they decided to retire 18.2% rather than surplusing their RECs. And they, if they would have sold these RECs for $3 a piece, they would have recouped $1.8 million. So I feel that we could sell these RECs and recoup $23,000, and I feel that would be in the best interest of our ratepayers. And a question from the gentleman earlier on this meeting. He asked where the U.S. geothermal was, and it's in Malta, Idaho. There's some hot springs over there that have a pretty good sized energy generating site. And that is all the questions, I believe.
You know, one item you might mention is that geothermal, unlike solar and wind, is not intermittent. So it's pretty well there when you need it. So.
Tyler, do you have some sense when we sell these RECs, are they resold, or do they create a void for the renewable energy provider? In other words, does it harm them?
They are resold. So for example, any of these, all these tech companies that are out there trying to paint their energy green, they will buy the attributes, and then they will be able to call themselves green energy providers.
Okay,
other discussion questions? Well, do we have a motion?
Yeah, I'll motion that we approve resolution 2178-20, authorizing the disposal of surplus renewable energy credits.
I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to pass resolution 2178-20, authorizing the disposal of surplus renewable energy credits. All those in favor? Aye.
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 Okay, the motion passes. Okay, Tyler, you got another one. The next item is the Clallam 10-Year Utility Resource Plan.
Yes, this is a requirement by the Department of Commerce. This is done every 2 years. It is required to be displayed at a public meeting. And the base year is 2018, and then it's a 10-year resource plan based on BPA's load forecast. And the conservation portion of this comes from our conservation potential assessment. As you can see out in the 10-year future, it basically our conservation diminishes our need to purchase additional electricity, at least for tier two. So the conservation potential assessment is performed by EES. They have just recently been bought out by GDS Consulting. They have a few actuaries that are on staff that collect data for this. And staff recommends approval of this document.
Right. I'd have to mention one item. Conservation is not free.
Right.
We pay 30% of the cost. 70% of the cost is in Bonneville rates. So we're avoiding paying for electricity, but it's like the old demand side management that utilities used to do. There is a cost, and it is in rates.
So what is the rate impact?
Oh, pardon me, what was the question?
So if it's in the rates, Commissioner Purser said it's in the rates. How is it? Is there a number?
I believe that it's not granular. It's sort of included within our tier one costs.
Okay.
Well, one of the big criticisms that Bonneville, they may pay 70% of the cost, but it's considered somewhat expensive because Bonneville has all this administrative cost. They have cast of thousands doing this. They've only accept certain conservation measures, and for years there's been the discussion of the utilities just handling all the conservation programs ourselves. That hasn't quite got legs yet, but it's still out there. Okay, do we have a motion or other questions?
Yeah, I have one other question. So is on the conservation line and efficiency, is that primarily where we have incentives for people to upgrade appliances and ductless heat pumps and things like that? Is that pretty much what that line is limited to, or I'm just wondering?
Yes, that is correct. That is primarily our conservation programs.
Okay.
Tyler, where does solar fit in here?
We really don't have enough solar to really impact this resource plan at this time.
The spreadsheet has these other sources,
mm-hmm.
and I guess it's other renewables. Is that where solar would go?
Yeah, yes.
So what's the point of us approving this? It's simply a reporting requirement to the Secretary of Commerce?
Correct.
Part of the Energy Independence Act requirements.
And so they want the commissioners to approve it. Okay, so I mean, I haven't seen this before, of course, but I just want to understand why it's important for us commissioners to approve it and what, fully understanding the implications of all this. But I guess all it is just projecting our conservation against our our purchases from BPA to show that we're
back in the lake already.
We show that we're reducing demand.
Somebody's not muted.
Yeah, the Department of Commerce has utilities report their needs just to make sure that there's enough energy in the region to satisfy those needs.
So how did you come up with these numbers?
Well, the loads come from BPA's load forecast, and they're anticipating a 0.3% load growth over the next 10 years. Conservation is right off of our conservation potential assessment that we have done by a consulting service. The conservation potential assessment is a requirement of the Energy Independence Act.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about the load growth, 0.3% BPA. Is that BPA wide and we apply it to our load? And so that's the same thing we
use. No, that's specific to our utility. They looked at
okay, got it. All right.
They look at the past 15 or so years and come up with an algorithm going into the future, and they weather adjust it so that this is sort of the best guess as what's going to happen for the next 5 to 10 years.
Okay. All right. I don't guess I have any other questions. Anybody else?
No. Well, does the Bonneville assessment include economic growth or projected economic growth?
Correct.
It does.
They look at economic growth, They look at residential, commercial, industrial makeup. They have several factors that play into this. The one thing that is the big unknown is the coronavirus. So that's it's kind of thrown a wrench in our forecast for this year.
Well, actually,
go ahead.
It looks bad enough already. Okay.
Hey, Will, I do have something to add to what Tyler's saying. Keep in mind, when BPA looks at load growth, they're also considering the likelihood of a potentially large load coming in at megawatt, 2 megawatts, that is somewhat speculative. Our actual load growth for the last 6 years has been declining somewhat, but when you look at the potential of some larger loads coming in, then they get a slightly positive load growth. They did reduce their projections based on our last meeting from 0.6% to something closer to 0.2% or 0.3%.
Okay.
What kind of information do we provide them, John or Tyler, it seems like we ought to be telling them what we think our load's going to be.
Tyler, you may want to answer this, but we have an annual meeting where we sit down with BPA and we give them what we see for new additions of customers, the effectiveness of conservation, the growth in net metering solar, which is not, you know, an outside purchase under any contract, as well as, trends that we're seeing in conservation. And then they take what we say plus with what they have, other information, and they come up with their number. But they do listen to us, and one of the things they have done in recent years is lower the growth potential based on what we convey. But I believe in this model is an assumption of some electric vehicle growth that is somewhat speculative, and we do not know if it's going to really happen or not. But if it does, it could be substantial.
Okay.
Okay, so do we have a motion on this one?
Yeah, I move that we approve the subject spreadsheet to be sent to the Secretary of Commerce.
Yeah, I'll second that.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded to approve the Clallam County 10-year utility resource plan as submitted, which is based on BPA's load forecast. All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the motion is approved. All right, our next item is correspondence communications. We've got Clallam County PUD reaps the benefits of IT enterprise solutions. Who's doing that one?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and do that, Will. Before I started, though, we had one of our customers here, Jim, ask a question regarding when we bought the RECs. Of course, I-937 was back in 2006. That was passed. Back in those days, we were forecasting, and the crystal ball was telling everybody that RECs were going to be costing $50, and it was just an unknown situation at the time. And what we did, when you look at our curve, and it's a curve out throughout the years of our tier one. If we started adding things like any other wind or solar, the way it was ending up, it was actually eating into our tier one power. And the tier one at the time was around $30, $31. And back then, solar was looking at $110, and wind was like $90. That's kind of how we got to RECs. RECs actually do not eat into our tier one. That was the big beauty of the RECs. So As we added the RECs, we met our requirements of 3% and back then for I-937. And so that's kind of how it all started. And we were, a matter of fact, when we looked at the other utilities, we were one of the lowest cost ones in the state. Matter of fact, one of the utilities bought into a large wind farms, and when California passed the regulations that only 25% of their power can be bought from out of state, that particular utility went ahead and had an 18% rate increase that year. So we felt we had and continue to do an excellent job. Fortunately, RECs costs has come down and stayed down, even though it was anticipated that they were going to go up quite a bit. So I just wanted to answer that. I hope that answers some of the questions there. It's a pretty complex thing that's been happening over the last 10, 13 years. So I believe we've done an excellent job on that. Now going to the communications here, correspondence. We had American Public Power Association printed an article regarding us, and it was Clallam County PD reaps the benefits of IT enterprise solutions. And what it talks about is our NISC, the software system that we implemented over the last few years. NISC stands for National Information Solutions Co-op. It's a software system that many of the co-ops, cooperative utilities, use. And it's the great thing about it is that all the different solutions that we've had in the past are different software, have been combined, so they're all kind of real-time talking to each other. And everything's done with the system now, talks to each other in real-time. And we included this article in the packet, and I would encourage everybody to read it. It's an excellent article talking about one of the strategies, the technologies that we use here for efficiency, more efficient. It has OMS, outage management system. It combines with the GIS system. It combines with payroll. It combines with the crews out in the field making changes, real-time changes. Makes paperless timesheets, and it even provides training through videos for our CSRs, which, when you get a new CSR in the past, it takes a lot of time from everybody. This time has really reduced the number of time or the required time to train our CSRs. So it's a great article that I encourage you all to read, and you can learn a lot about what progress we've made in the last 3 to 5 years. So I think that's about it, Will. I just wanted to say it's out there, and it's a good article from APPA.
Okay, thank you, Doug. All right, next item is commissioner reports. Dave, you want to kick it off?
Sure. I think the highlights of the last couple weeks has been the WAPUTA meetings that were conducted between the 15th and the 17th, and I think the telecom committee meeting, one I'll probably concentrate on here, is quite a bit of discussion there. And I know Will said he was going to mention an item about the PDC from the government affairs meeting, so I won't go into that. I guess the first thing was mentioned is that in Skagit PUDs, it's kind of a general public power issue that one of their commissioners, Aaron Berg, accepted a job as a court commissioner, or as the executive director of the Port of Port Townsend. So he's had to move out of Skagit County and relinquish his last 2 years of his six-year term on the board. So just like I was appointed 2 years ago, they've been seeking to appoint a replacement, and they had 19 applicants, which I think is a good thing. It's a good sign that there's a lot of people interested in public power. And just the only thing I want to mention, it's good to see so many people interested in applying for these positions. The other thing that was discussed at the telecom meeting was that the there's a move afoot to change the wording in the RCW that grants authority to PUDs for broadband service to change the word wholesale to retail. And there was a number of PUDs that whose initial response will just make sure that it's wholesale or retail, because like everything else with local control, we want to give options to the each individual PUD to make the decision and not make anything a mandate from the state, rather just granting authority. Another thing that was mentioned, Steve Schoffler, our IT manager here, noted that for Clallam PUD and others where it would take a significant amount of fiber extension to serve the entire service area. In fact, looking at 3 to 4 times the amount of fiber that currently exists in this PUD and several others, I'm sure, that just the global demand for fiber alone would make this a 3 to 4 year project just to get that physical work done after the approvals and everything had been made. And it was noted by several PUDs that have done extensive fiber that there's a considerable lead time for getting permits from WashDOT and others where you're going across roads or using right-of-ways and things like that. So, you know, 3 to 4 years, again, is just the construction time for something like that. So with COVID, there's been an added impetus to get more fiber, more broadband coverage by whatever means, but I think we're, as we take a closer look at this, we're getting a more precise cost on what it's going to take in terms of both money and time. And with respect to the cost, I know during 2019 face-to-face telecom meetings, Kitsap PUD, Grant PUD, and a few others have thrown out the number $30,000 to connect each site. And when they say connect, they mean get to the end of the driveway. That elusive last mile, as they say, is, gets very expensive. And I noticed at those meetings there was a lot of eyebrows raised at that when that $30,000 figure was thrown out. Now I see in the New York Times had an editorial on July 18th, a couple days after our meeting, that they have a photo of a teacher in Port Angeles sitting in a parking lot using the Wi-Fi hotspot as the headliner for the article. And it basically encourages expansion of broadband by whatever means to make sure that especially the rural areas are getting better service so that hotspots aren't as heavily relied upon in the future. They mention a town, Liberty Township, in the suburban area of Cincinnati, Ohio, $30,000 per site there. So this $30,000 number has been kicked around a lot. But I think the thing that has to be looked at is that these 30,000 figures are in areas that don't really resemble much of Clallam County. So at this meeting, also Chelan PD, which has already done quite an extensive fiber installation compared to most, they're now looking at going out into some of their less densely populated areas. And they mentioned that their estimate for getting into the Entioch Valley, which is terrain that looks similar to a lot of Clallam County, is $200,000 to get to the end of the driveway per site. So I didn't get to see whether any eyebrows are raised. These Zoom meetings, it's kind of hard to do that, but it definitely raised my eyebrows. And so, and then I think Okanagan PD mentioned that, yeah, when you get into these types of areas also, you got much higher O&M costs down the road. So I think it's good that we're starting to hone in on more specifics, because up to now there's been a lot of general information about expansion of fiber, and definitely going to have to be taking a look what some of the real numbers are depending on the area we're trying to serve. That's enough for me today. I think I'll let the other commissioners take it from there.
Okay, Jim?
Okay, well, I'll start with a couple meetings at the Waputa thing I did. A round table the first day, with different going around to different PUDs. One of the things they asked about is what kind of public participation we were getting with our BOC meetings, and whether they were in person or not. And three or four of them are actually doing in person with their commissioners, and everybody else is like Zoom or something or calling in. A lot of folks said that their participation was down. I pointed out that ours is not really all that different. We're still getting 5 or 6 or 10 people, depending on the subjects at hand, calling in and participating. So I think we're doing better than most in terms of public participation, which is great. I reported out on the various things going on here and, obviously, part of the discussion was about what's going on with COVID, the impacts, and, of course, everybody's talking about the LA crews are back to work and that sort of thing. But some of them talked about, what the impacts are. I try to point out that for us, understanding our business situation here in Clallam County with our customers is still really a mixed story based on, the data we get on delinquent payments and so forth, the 60, 90-day range and so forth, and what all that means. We're not really sure. And I'll come back to that later in another meeting I had. I told them what we were doing with the city of Port Angeles and let's see, that's about it for the roundtable. The energy meeting was about an hour long. It was that day. But anyway, Nicholas Garcia gave a little bit of information on the CETA guidance. I thought I had a slide, but I realized it's on the presentation he gave, which I don't have. I don't know how to retrieve that slide now. But anyway, we went through the CETA guidance and the rulemaking and stuff like that and what they're doing to keep track of all that. They also, the meeting was taken up with Kurt Miller from Northwest River Partners talking about EPA's TMDL, whatever you want to call it, report, plan, that they submitted to the state of Washington. And he pointed out, he gave the history of, the litigation and all that stuff that took on for years. And that was okay, informative. But he didn't have it on a slide, but he said that the water is actually warmer, is above the TMDL standards as it comes out of Idaho into the state of Washington. So he pointed out that it doesn't do any good to you don't lower temperatures by reducing by breaching the Snake River dams. I thought that was off, but I didn't have anything handy. But I did check with Columbia River Keepers, and they sent me something a couple days ago. And they said, no, that's not what the TMDL report says. And they said there's a chart, and I need to look at it before I, hang my hat on this because I always like to see the raw data. But there is a chart, he says, in the Columbia River Keepers says is in the TMDL report that shows that temperatures don't exceed those standards, and they are the reservoirs are actually creating in the Snake River are creating most of the TMDL problems, not what's entering, particularly when you take Dorjak into account, which has a lot of really cold water. Anyway, I'll look into that, and if I think I need to say something, correct that, I'll write something up and send it back to the Energy Committee, and maybe they can do something with it. And then on the I think, Will, maybe you, well, I, yeah, government affairs, I guess I was listening in on that, but I'll let Will talk about that. On the board of directors meeting on Friday, Elliot Meinzer was the speaker. And so after, you know, introductions and a lot of compliments and so forth, he talked about surcharges, the rate surcharge was the right thing to do, you know, to take care of people immediately. But then he said he's guardedly optimistic about rate increases or, you know, rates in general. So we'll see. He mentioned that the draft environmental impact statement was a monumental undertaking and lift for people. And of course, it comes out on the 31st of July along with a biological opinion. So we'll have to see what that says, because all of those recommendations, no matter what, in the draft EIS and BIOP have an impact on rates and BPA's cost. So we'll have to pay close attention to that. He said he didn't know if SPIL is working. Of course, I think the answer to that is no, it's not working. We knew it wouldn't work. This is the additional SPIL that was derived at through court injunctions by environmental groups. No matter what metric you use, it's not working. But the key one is fish returns over the up the Lower Snake River to Lower Granite are really bad, another bad year this year. So it's not helping at all. It's just wasting money. Let's see. He talked about resource adequacy process through the Northwest Power Pool. A lot of effort going into that. He said he's encouraged by the work. But as I kind of reported, I think, in the last meeting about WAPAG, our discussions there, is that we really need to watch this thing very closely because the adequacy study is a much broader scope than Bonneville Power Administration. And so what we always have to be mindful for as a Tier 1 or ratepayers like we are, $36 a megawatt hour, and you look at what's open to the rest of the Northwest is the secondary sales of oversupply, surplus, whatever you want to call it. And it gets sold in all kind of different ways, everything from the spot market to midterm contracts. But what are they paying for that? And this may be where this term that one of the folks in the public comments mentions about subsidies. We have to be careful here that the Tier 1, the $36 a megawatt hour customers aren't, in fact, subsidizing other parts of the Pacific Northwest outside of BPA's authority area. And basically what that is we're talking about is the PUDs here. Are we getting the best deal we can out of this this process? Because at the end of the day, the resource adequacy process being, you know, that's in place with the power pool in December or so forth is basically when they're done, they're going to be looking for obligations from the generators or the providers, the authorities and utilities, such as BPA. So what has BPA got to throw out there that they don't already have under contract now with the 20-year contracts? So that's one question we really have to pay attention to on this resource adequacy stuff. A few people asked questions, mostly about the Columbia River Treaty, and, you know, that's a really a slow-motion machine and everything. And so it primarily affects some of the other PUDs, particularly those that have dams. I asked about what he saw as forecast for, you know, if secondary sales were really working out. Because the BPA operations report that I've been getting every month or so or sooner is showing that the prices they're getting for secondary sales are a lot lower than last year. And, of course, last year we ended up with surcharges into this year. So I asked that question, and he said, well, it's above the forecasts, but prices are really low. I'll say they're low. 3 days ago at the California Intertie, surplus power, which at the time Bonneville was putting out about 5,000-6,000 megawatts, was going across in various packaging modes, contracts, spot market, you name it. But anyway, at the California interchange,
minus $45 a megawatt hour. So, and here we are in the middle of the summer, in the middle of the day, and we're and somebody is paying BPA, I guess, for a certain amount of power, certainly not all 6,000 megawatts, but some of that they're paying $45 a megawatt hour for Californians to take. So I don't know. It still doesn't add up to me, the secondary sales issue. Okay, so let me – that was what I will cover in the WAPUTA. The next thing I did was the Clallam County Economic Development Council, which I'm on the board. We had a board meeting on the 22nd. We went over the operating budget and so forth, and it's interesting to note that they were typically a $200,000 to $300,000 sort of budgeted organization. That's what they were dealing with in terms of their resources to fund things and do studies and so forth, pay staff. And now they're up to $1.3 billion because of all the COVID-related fund inputs and so forth. So they're going to hire a part-time person to help administer all that those grant that funding and so forth. And my eraser just fell off. Okay, so and as we went around, I reported out that we're, like I said at the WAPUTA meeting, we're still trying to understand what our business customers might be facing here, and that the two things that we're looking at is our delay payments and what kind of response we're getting from our customer service folks that, Doug, you've mentioned that we're not getting a lot of calls and so forth. And so we're not sure exactly where this is headed, but one of the board members piped up and said, well, it's going to get worse. Winter's going to be hard on businesses. And, of course, I pointed that out, too. You know, if you think it's hard now to pay your power bill, wait till we get to winter time. And so they agreed with that and basically said that the situation is going to get worse. There are going to be continued business losses in the county, and so that we should expect something. They pointed out that only a third of the business have no cash reserve, and about another half only have enough for like a month. So it's not a really good business outlook here. And I guess they threw out a pretty high business failure rate, but a couple of us asked for the county commissioner mentioned, but we asked for citations. They didn't have anything, so I don't want to use the number. Okay, that's all I have.
Jim, this is Doug. Did they talk about EDC has the money from CARES for businesses? Did they mention anything about that?
Well, it's the same breakout that the same money I think that you talked about the other day, and that we get $26,000 for, and they've got that money, but I don't think they've got anything new. There's still over $1 billion that Governor Inslee hasn't doled out, and they talked about that because that's becoming a concern, because that money has to be spent by the end of the year, and I fail to ask what's the definition of the end of the year? Is it 30 December or some other date? I'm not
sure. Our money's, I think, October 31st.
Well, that doesn't give anybody much time to spend money here. So anyway, that chunk of money we should have gotten a lot of. They did point out that there was a question about whether the I-5 people are getting that money, and it says, actually, the bigger cities, the bigger counties get direct funding from the feds. And so what this money is for smaller towns and communities, and it's still in limbo in the governor's office. So that's the primary part of that they discussed, Doug.
Okay. Yeah, they get more, or they got more for business utilities than we did for residential, I believe. But I guess you'll find out whenever that comes out.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, well, moving on. I'd like to make a couple of points. The EPA monitors the water temperature in the Columbia and Snake River system. And that's their data.
that says that the water temperature is coming across the Canadian border and across from Idaho exceeds Washington standards. That's not, that didn't come from River Partners. That came from the EPA. So having said that, and the other thing about those surplus sales, you know, you pointed out that actually Bonneville has to pay people to take their power at some point. This is what we went through here recently with economic dispatch, curtailment of Columbia Generating Station, just because there's surplus power. So it's not a matter of selling power that's needed in the Northwest to subsidize California. All right. I attended a BPA webinar. The topic was resource adequacy. I won't go into it in great detail, a lot of technical computer modeling and that sort of thing. Their presentation is on their website, so if anybody wants to look at it, they can do so. What they're doing is they're doing a resource program which will forecast the loads versus resources over the next 20 years. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. They're also doing a needs assessment matrix where they're working with the Northwest Power Pool on resource adequacy, and that matrix would be available in some time period. I think we'd like to see that as well. So anyway, it went on. It was a good presentation. I think they need to improve how they announce these things so we'll have an opportunity to participate. Also went to the Waputo Roundtable. I think we covered most of that. The chairmen of the various committees at Waputo, it's kind of interesting. They just rolled them all over. There was no takers on stepping into the chairmanships. Very interesting presentation by Matt, and I'm not even going to try to pronounce his name. It's Poehnke. He's the state representative from the Tri-Cities area. Very knowledgeable on cybersecurity, has a computer background. And the discussion came up. First, he talked about hacking. And kind of scary scenarios there. Things like if you own a fax machine, that can easily be used as a backdoor to your router and to your system. So I've got one of those. I'll have to look into that. It came up that the Public Disclosure Commissioner Commission's reporting processes requirements leaves elected officials and government employees vulnerable to hacking. Since you have to put on there a list of your accounts, the financial institutions, their addresses, and the a range of what your investments are, your holdings there. There's been a number of cases where public officials have been hacked and ended up with some financial hit on from the hacking. What he said was is that, of course, this came about as I think somebody mentioned earlier, lack of trust in elected officials. But he pointed out that basically the Public Disclosure Commission has gone further than the law requires in these reporting in their reporting requirements, and that the legislature is looking at this and looking at some revisions to reduce the vulnerability. It was also talked about that this is an impediment to getting people to run for public office, which is pretty sad. They don't want to put their information out there to that degree and that detail because it does leave them open to hacking or whatever. So, and the other thing was is that people will go on the PDC website, find out this information, and use it to harass public officials. Then we went into the roundtable. Just a few little points there. Mason 3 has signed an agreement with Energy Northwest for technical services. They didn't go into detail of what that is, but I'll find out and report back. Chelan PUD had transferred $25,000 to the county's emergency fund to address the virus measures. And Benton is working on a clean energy policy. They said that there's a huge wind farm that's being looked at for their area, where none of the electrons will stay on the east side, of course. But they're concerned about that and following that. Then on with Waputo, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating some of your report, Dave, but talk about the PUD providing retail broadband. And it was kind of agreed that the easiest fix there would be just change the language in the RCWs to eliminate wholesale, and rather than getting into a rewrite that, and you know, there's concern that, that PUDs would be obligated to provide broadband when it was not economically viable to do so. NOINET gave a report. They're upgrading their system to 300 gig, which qualifies as a universal service level. Didn't talk about cost of doing that, but it'd be interesting to find out what they're going to have to spend on that and whether they're going to need additional loans to do that. The Energy Committee got a CETA update. The draft rules, there's some concern about that the rules may exceed the law. Tim Sheldon gave a report on this, and he says that's pretty common, and you have to really police those rule-making procedures. And we already talked about Kurt Miller's report on River Partners. Then George Kahn talked about legislative priorities. They expect for another bill to be introduced for cap and trade in the next session. It's kind of interesting that, you know, there's a lot of call for having another session before the November elections. And it's speculated that there's a lot of resistance there because that session, there would be a lot of new taxes that would come up. And, of course, politicians don't want to raise taxes just before the election. That's no surprise. Some of the things that will come up either in a special session or in the normally scheduled session would be the B&O tax, Energy Independence Act relief, CETA rules, tax reform, dollars to customers where this the gift of public funds issue, telecom, more rural service, consolidation of water systems, local PUD control, and, of course, the budget. There's I think it was a $9 billion shortfall. It was the number that was tossed out. Then the Waputo board met. Not a lot to report there. There was discussion about DPA activities. Of course, Elliot was in that meeting, as Jim just talked about. One of the items that was mentioned was residential exchange. This is where we pay IOU customers. We're supposed to, the logic was that IOU customers contributed to the building of the hydro system through taxes, so should be getting benefits. And initially that was going to be power. But it's kind of evolved into just payments of large amounts of money to the IOUs, which is supposed to flow down to their customers. Now, whether that happens or not, not sure. But Elliot kind of described that as being kind of still an issue, but not a lot we can do about it to this point, although we should continue to try. He praised Energy Northwest as being a good partner for Bonneville. Talk briefly about the extension of the Columbia Generating Station license. And You talked about resource adequacy, the closing of coal strip, and the elimination of coal-generated power was contributing to the concern about resource adequacy. He did mention secondary sales. They said they're above forecast. They're now at $260 million for the year. But it's a very volatile market. That was an Energy Northwest report. Talked about the Participants Review Board elections, which I think I reported on previously. Economic Dispatch, which I think I've reported on that, where Columbia's been called on to reduce power down to almost 25%, in fact, to shut down for some period of time. If anybody remembers Brent Ridge, he was vice president at Energy Northwest and moved on. He's now in Wisconsin as CEO of a, I believe it's a cooperative there anyway, a smaller utility. Let's see if I can cut this short. George also mentioned that all meetings will be virtual till November. The November-December meeting will be, of course, virtual. And there was a discussion about that this might last well into, if not through, the first quarter of next year. It all depends on the vaccine and whether it's available and whether it's viable and tested. He's asking, or he's kind of proposing, that we try to have a first in-person meeting in February. But there's not going to be any legislative reception in January. They're talking about having a reception in a box. And I'm at a loss to know what that is, but we'll see what happens. Anyway, that's enough. That's kind of a synopsis. Okay, staff reports. The first one is energy efficiency conservation update on the EV charging station. Matthias, are you on?
Yeah, I'm here. Can everybody hear me? Great. Yep. So I'm sorry, I don't have a camera, but I have slides. I'm going to try to share my screen here. Can everybody see that?
Yep.
Yep.
Great. Great. So I was glad to hear all the questions you had on energy efficiency when Tyler talked about our resource plan. So hopefully I'll be able to answer some of those as a part of this presentation. But if you have any questions as we go along, feel free to ask. You know, I think what I'll do is I'll just sort of pause at each slide. But mostly what I'll be talking about is the Energy Independence Act. And as I was sitting here waiting, I realized I should have spelled that out on this first slide. But when you see EIA there, that stands for the Energy Independence Act. That requires us to set energy efficiency targets and then to meet those targets in two-year terms. So we'll be covering how the 2018-19 EIA biennium went, and then I'll be talking a little bit where we're at in the current EIA biennium, 2020-21. And then I'll touch a little bit on electric vehicles, since that seems to be of interest to the commissioners. And last time I was in front of you guys talking this winter, I believe it was back in February, I talked a little bit about electric vehicles. So last biennium, we're looking pretty good. We actually, the target was 9,198 megawatt hours. That was adopted by the board on November 13, 2017. So at that time, Ted and Hsu were commissioners along with you, Mr. Purser. What we do as a strategy, though, is we generally tend to overachieve our targets by 20%. So the target is sort of in statute because of the Energy Independence Act, but we try to do a little bit more. And that's partially as a hedge over the biennium because we'd much rather go a little bit over rather than below because get fined if we miss the target, and it can sometimes be a little hard to control exactly how much energy savings we get, because it's also driven by customer interest and what the customers want to invest in their facilities, what technology they want, et cetera. But then also we can use any excess in the current biennium in a future biennium. So we can carry forward the energy savings up to two bienniums and use 20% of that biennial period's target. So that's why we try to overshoot. So as you can look, as you can see in acquisition bar there, so 20% of that total target is actually savings that were rolled over, carried forward from the 2016-17 biennium. About 3,500 megawatt hour comes from regional efforts that are managed by the Northwest Energy Efficiency Alliance that we fund through Bonneville Power Administration. And then we just have those savings we just get to claim those towards our targets. And then just shy of 9,000 megawatt hours comes from our program. So, Commissioner Anderson, I think you're asking, you know, what that is, and you're absolutely correct. It's rebates for heat pumps, lighting, rebates for LEDs, those types of things. So then next slide here, I have a pie chart of the period's energy savings, where they came from, and the savings that we can control. And you can see the big pieces is commercial, which is just shy of 50%, and lighting. And the bar there for lighting is actually specifically residential lighting, so it's residential LEDs. And actually, the commercial, probably 95% is also LED lighting, and the 7% industrial energy savings we have there, that's also LED lighting. So it's a very important point, like how heavy we rely on LED savings. It has a big effect on the cost of the programs. Commissioner Persher, we're talking about costs. But it's also our customers love LEDs. So it's a very, very easy programs to manage. Then, of course, you know, another big piece is heating measures. But those generally are a little bit more expensive. And what we're talking about there, of course, is regular heat pumps and ductless heat pumps. Any questions? So next slide here is looking at cost, and what I have here is a bar chart of different costs from different programs. So you can kind of see a comparison, because what's sort of relevant is if you look at the smallest bars, which is residential lighting and the commercial, those, you know, because they represent such a big portion of our total savings, they play a big part in weighing down the total cost of our programs. On a net basis, we're just over $10 per megawatt, which is very, very cheap. It's below our wholesale price of energy. Our strategic target is to try to keep it below $43 a megawatt, which is our tier one purchase prices. And, you know, it's because of the simplicity of the LED programs, we're really crushing that strategic target currently. But it's important to note, however, residential lighting, this is the last year we claim any energy savings from residential lighting, because we believe that that's a technology that's mature enough that our customers are choosing it anyways without our incentives. So BPA's programs are ending for residential lighting, and so is ours. So the last month actually will be September, so we follow BPA's fiscal year. So after September, we no longer get savings from residential lighting. There's still a fair bit of commercial LED lighting available in our service territory, but essentially with this year and next year is sort of a transition into a different time or program, and we no longer have the benefit of that technology to keep our programs very, very cheap. We are audited for compliance. And that auditing process, you know, technically in the statute, it doesn't start until the May following the conclusion of a biennium. But we have asked the auditor to look at our targets a little bit earlier, because it would be nice to know if the auditor thinks we have any issues with the way we set our targets before the end of the biennium so that we can make any potential adjustments. And while we don't have an official ruling from the auditor, he did begin taking a look at our CPA back in May of 2019. And he hasn't indicated specifically that we're in the clear and that he, you know, agrees with our process, but he also has not indicated that there's any problems. I feel quite comfortable with that. And then they started the process of looking at our acquisition savings back in April of the current year. And we're not expecting a final report until the end of 2020, but we do know that we were invoiced for auditing activities in June, and next week we're supposed to get a request for backup data to support some of the conservation measures. So hopefully that will work out, but considering how we sort of overshot the target, I feel quite comfortable with that audit. And welcome the auditor's view into our programs. First for this year, I have started to look a little bit on system peak reductions. So generally, with our energy saving programs, we go after kilowatt hour savings. And historically, that's primarily been the focus in the Pacific Northwest. But with all the talk of resource adequacy and more reliance on intermittent resources, I figured it'd probably be a good idea to sort of calculate the ancillary benefit of our energy savings program and see how that affects our system peak. And it turns out that the council has values for most of our energy savings measures in terms of demand reduction. So we're also reducing our system peak by 1,500 kWs through our efforts. And then, as looking at that too, I actually figured out that the council actually have CO2 reduction values associated with many of our energy savings values. We also have saved just shy of 2,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide due to our energy efficiency effort. And that's a rather conservative number because that really only tallies up CO2 reductions associated with what we call with deemed energy savings. So when we have a custom calculated energy savings value, there's no tool to extract out the CO2 reductions from it, and hence I arrive at a conservative value that I feel comfortable presenting to you. Then moving forward to the current biennium, and there our target, as you commissioners adopted last year, is just shy of 7,000 megawatt hours. And then, of course, we are hoping to overshoot that by 20%. So we're looking at acquiring 8,200 megawatt hours for the biennial period. We started the year out pretty strong with a number of energy savings measures that we claimed early in January. So we, as you can see in this chart, we're well past halfway towards our targets. But with the COVID pandemic, our programs have slowed down a little bit. So if it wasn't for it, I would be standing here at my desk, being really comfortable meeting the target. But this year, we'll have to pay a little closer attention to it because also we have NEA savings, which historically have been very reliable. But my guess is that there'll be a little bit of reduction in those as well due to sort of dampened economic activity. But once again, that's one reason why we do have a strategy to roll over some savings. So we start the year with some hedge. So I'm hopeful and confident that we should be able to meet this target over this period as well. But of course, there's, as everybody knows, there's things at play that are a little bit outside of our control. In terms of resource mix, while the colors are a little different in this bar chart, the acquisition to date over the first 6 months of the year is very similar to what it traditionally has been. It is a lot of LED lighting with also lots of heating measures reflecting the largely residential service territory that we have. In terms of cost of our programs, we're still very cheap, and I just used sort of a different chart this time to show it's a little speedometer. I don't know if anybody ever comes down to my cubicle area, but I have some charts and things up on my wall that you're free to look at where I sort of track progress over time. but we're still well below the strategic target, and it looks like I didn't change 2019. It should be 2020, but it's the same strategic target as it was for 2019. A little bit more expensive so far this year, but still well below what we're aiming for. As a comparison over time, I also just included this last chart here just to show how we have different targets year after year and how generally we overshoot the targets. As LED savings goes away, like I mentioned before, 2022-23 biennium is likely to look very differently from what it has in the past, because a lot of what you're looking at there is savings from, in the early years, it was compact fluorescent lamps, and as of late has been LED lighting. And it's generally being adopted and utilized everywhere, included within our own system. And lastly, electric vehicles. And there's not a ton of progress, really, but Energy Northwest did submit an application to the Department of Commerce for a couple of electric vehicle chargers that will hopefully go within our service territory. Their general plan, or what they applied for, is to build a charging corridor along Highway 101, sort of a closed loop, so that tourists could come out and visit utilizing electric vehicle. The apparent successful grantee will be nice announced in December, so there's still some time before we know for sure what that will happen. But essentially, at that time, Department of Commerce will start a negotiation process with some grantees and see which one works out best. So hopefully I will know more towards the end of the year. And to conclude, we met and exceeded the biennial target for 2018-19. While the audit is still forthcoming, we're tracked to meet the 2020-21 EIA biennial targets, and we're waiting on Department of Commerce for approval of the Energy Northwest ED grant application. Any questions?
Yeah, with us, you know, some years ago we were talking about that we've been doing conservation even before it was required.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were kind of burned through all the low-hanging fruit. And so this was the cost of conservation measures will go up in the future. Have you done any kind of projections to see where that's headed?
Generally, I don't have firm projections out beyond into 2023 per se. But if we go back to the this bar graph, you know, essentially what will happen is if you remove resident, you know, you can see those programs that cost a little more. Like, for instance, I don't know if you can see my pointer here, but RES H2O is essentially heat pump water heater, residential water heating energy savings. And you see the cost of that program is around $35 a megawatt. For heat pump, ductless heat pumps, it's fairly cheap. For traditional heat pumps, which is the bar rest heat pumps, you know, just like heat pump water heaters, that's about $35 a megawatt. So that's kind of the price range we're looking at in terms of dollar per megawatt hour of energy savings when we go past LEDs. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Just one other point. At Energy Northwest, they've been talking about putting charging stations on the 101 loop for 2 years at least.
Yeah.
I think I announced it as a dedication of the solar facility here. Any idea what's taking so long on that? Is it the government grant process or what?
I think it essentially is the government grant process. Yeah, I spoke to Jennifer with Energy Northwest before last week, so before this presentation, and that she gave me this timeline. But I know that also the state, you know, is working under furlough. So right now, Department of Commerce, you know, is taking a day off every week during July, and then a day off every month, you know, through the end of the year, you know, so I'm certain that has some effect on the timeline as well.
Yeah, makes sense. Thank you. Other questions?
No.
Okay, before we move on to the next item, let's take a five-minute break, which will end up being 10 minutes, but anyway, that's fine. Okay, there, everybody back, or I guess not. Dave, are you back?
I'm back, yes.
Ah, good for you. All right, well, let's get started. Our next item is the CARES update. I think that's Doug. Uh-oh, is Doug on?
I think he took your 10 minutes, literally.
Yes. That's it. No more breaks. Oh, there he is. Doug, we're ready for the CARES update.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go ahead with this. Just in general, we're receiving $45,200. We've been talking to a number of the other utilities, PUDs, and as far as we've heard, none of them have received any CARES money. So we're very fortunate to be able to work closely with the county and with the city and OLECAP in this case. So Washington State, just an update, tell you we're in the middle of signing a CARES subrecipient agreement with the county. We worked with the people down there, Mark Lane and the group down there. And Washington State originally has allocated the county federal stimulus funding, CARES. And CARES stands for Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act. So with that, the Board of Commissioners of the county directing up to $45,200 to residential utility assistance for the residents of Collin County. So it's just for residential. We have just residential money that we're getting. As I mentioned earlier, EDC is getting the money for businesses. Let's see, and it should be fully distributed by October 31st, 2020. So we have not yet received the money, but are hoping within a week or so that we will receive it. We're also overseeing the program, and the eligible residents, let me give you a list here that they talk about. Individuals seeking CARES funding through the program with us has to be a Collin County resident, has to be a Collin County residential utility account holder, have incurred a financial hardship due to COVID public health emergency, such as a job loss, reduced work hours, layoff, illness, or other circumstances leading to a significant reduction in household income. A priority to be given to customers subject to utility disconnects for non-payment. Have or will agree to enter into a payment plan for utility fee arrears not covered by the CARES relief provided under this program. Consent to disclose and release by Collin PUD to Collin County all of the information gathered during the application process and details of award granted under this program. And the grant limitations, one utility assistance grant will be awarded per household. So, In working with this, we work closely with the county. Shanda and others have put together responses to back and forth with the county and come up with an agreement. And the applicants have to apply using a COVID-19 financial assistance application that will be available on our website. And the customer service group here will be reviewing that. I might mention, too, that we've been working closely with OLECAP. Now, OLECAP, the money they're getting is for rent and mortgage assistance, and it's about $214,000. So the importance of that is if these customers are getting rent and mortgage assistance, of course, that frees up more money for them to, pay their utility bills too. And working closely with them, we'll be inserting one of their mailers in our delinquent notices when they go out. So that's helping Ole Camp to let them know, too, that there's this other assistance available. And additionally, LIHEAP funding goes to Ole Cap. I think I've been saying camp. I'm sorry, Ole Cap. And they can use that money that they get from the LIHEAP. Ole Cap can use that to help customers pay their utilities bills also. So there is some help out there. And we're looking forward, like I said, hopefully get this money coming in pretty soon. Commissioners are having a meeting here, I think this week, and approve this, and then I believe we'll be receiving the money soon after. So that's kind of the program. It's a nice program that we're happy to be involved in, and look forward to receiving the money to help our customers.
Isn't there effort underway in Congress to come up with a second phase of this?
Yeah, I believe so. But at that last meeting that Sean and I were on with the county, we were told that they don't see that money coming in the near future. So I'm not sure if there'll be any of that or not.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions, comments?
Doug, you mentioned the number 40-something million that we would get, and I mentioned 26. Is that 26 now, 47?
Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Originally, our share was going to be 25,000 approximately, and they upped it to 45,200. So there was an increase there, right? Well, you're muted, Will.
Yeah, I am. What was that based on? How did the county determine how to divvy out that money?
Well, they had come up originally when we had getting that $25,000 that we were going to get. That was a $200,000 that the county decided to give to the PUD, City of Port Angeles, and Ole Cap. And when they upped the number, it's just a percentage, we ended up with the $25,000. So they had a set amount of money that they were going to provide us originally. And then they upped that by $150,000, I believe. So it was like $350,000, and we got, I think, about 13% of that came to us.
Do we have some criteria about how people can get this money, or is it somebody else giving us the criteria?
No, we worked with the county to come up with the criteria that they agreed to, and so we do have a criteria. Now, one of the things, too, is the applicants, they have to fill out their applications, which we'll have online, and when they fill it out, one of the things that they have to do is they have to provide some proof that they have suffered because of COVID-19, whether it's a doctor's notice or unemployment, something that substantiates so that if an audit is done, it shows that they were impacted by COVID-19.
Is that similar to what the City of Port Angeles has on their website for applying?
It will be similar to theirs, right. Yeah, the county worked with City of PA separately. They worked with us separately and worked with Ole Cap separately to come up with a separate agreement, sub-recipient agreements.
Yeah, well, when I looked at the city's application process, it was pretty simple. So it's not like a whole ton of stuff somebody would have to fill out.
Yeah, no, that was the number one thing we were pushing for is simplicity. Matter of fact, we were originally looking at just the honor system and saying that you were impacted, but the county requires us to get some kind of proof that they were impacted.
Sounds like getting verification would be the biggest time consumer.
Right.
Okay. Anything else on that?
Nothing else on that, Will.
Okay. Now we come to the big one here. Update on 2020 second quarter KPIs. That's Doug and direct reports.
Yeah, let me go ahead and start this. What I'm going to do is just kind of show you real brief. Let me share something here with you. See if this works. Well, so far no good.
No, I
right. You got it?
I can see it, yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Okay, so what we have here is our strategic plan for 2020. And let me go through here, see if I can advance it. There we go. We have 11 strategic objectives, and these are them, all the way from provide stable rates through to financial responsibilities. We have customers on the left-hand margin here, internally, things that we work on and enablers to get there, and the financial is kind of the bottom or the base of the whole thing. It has our vision here of being the best utility for our customers, and the mission is providing reliable, efficient, safe, and low-cost utility services in a financially and environmentally responsible manner across the top there. So what we're going to do today is we're going to address each one of these objectives, and we'll be looking at here's an example, ensure reliable supply. Each one of the objectives has a definition. It has a picture of excellence. It has identified big gaps to the picture of excellence. So what do we have to do to reach that picture of excellence? Here's some of the gaps that we identify. And then strategic initiative. These are how do we close those gaps and get closer to the picture of excellence. We have a direct report lead up in the right-hand corner for each one of these, and those report leads are going to be the ones that will be presenting this. And each one of them, this one happens to have two pages, but all the others are just on one page. But on the second page on this one, we also have the key performance indicators. And these performance indicators, any of you that have done strategic plans, I showed you a balanced scorecard in that second slide. It took a number of years to get these all set up. And these KPIs do change as time goes on when we find ways of better measuring a particular objective. They're probably the most difficult part of putting together a strategic plan and strategic objectives. So as I mentioned, direct report will be going through this. I'll give you another quick example here. This one was on financially responsible, and it shows the same things: definition, picture of excellence, big gaps to the picture of excellence, strategic initiatives, and then finally the key performance indicators. So Sean will be doing this one when we get to that. So what we are going to start off with, we're going to start up with the one that was on the top, which was stable rates. And with that, Sean will be talking about the stable rates, and then he'll be going to, let me bring this up again here, then he'll do all the ones where he has the leads on, and then we'll go to the next one, ensure reliable, and then John will pick it up and he'll do all the ones that he has a lead on, and Tom also has that as one of his objectives. So that's pretty much the way it'll go, and let me stop sharing here mine and let those guys get theirs, starting with Sean here.
Okay, thanks, Doug. Just a second here. I'll get my screen shared. Can you guys see the
slideshow? It's up now, Sean.
Good. Okay, so what does?
No, I said it was up now.
Okay.
It looks good.
All right, so I'll try not to take too long here, but I do have three strategic objectives, and they are provide stable rates. I have one section in manage resource portfolio, and then be financially responsible. And then not part of the KPIs, I did include a quick overview of some graphs and statistics on our COVID arrears. So jumping in here, on provide stable rates, the definition is minimal budget fluctuations to support rate stability for district customers. And our picture of excellence is provide stable rates to customers with no more than a 1% rate adjustment over the previous five-year average rate adjustment. And then over 10 years, our capital costs should be within 85% of our depreciation. So the first KPI here, and these numbers are through June 30th of 2020, so through the second quarter. The first KPI is to have electric revenue and expenses within 5% of budget to receive a green rating, 5 to 8% of budget to get yellow, and then greater than 8% would be red. And so through the second quarter, our actual revenue came in very close to budget. We budgeted $39.5 million, and we're actually at $39.8, so slightly above our budget.
Excuse me, Sean. Excuse me. Can you get your microphone up a little bit closer to your mouth?
Is that better, Doug?
No, a little bit closer to your mouth, the microphone part.
Is that better?
Okay. It seems a little low still, but I'm sorry.
We
can hear you, but it's just a little softer than normal.
Yeah, okay. I can hear you fine. Maybe it's your volume, Doug. I don't know.
If you can't hear me, let me know, Doug. So moving on, the expenses did come in yellow, and that's because we budgeted $41 million, and we're actually at $37.9 million. And this can solely be attributed to COVID. As you know, we stopped quite a few operations back in March, and as a result, we've spent less on capital projects. And I believe when John goes, he's going to talk about some of the projects that have been delayed as a result of COVID, but that has definitely thrown off our expenses through the second quarter of this year. Water revenue, same criteria for the KPI, has to be within 5% for green. The revenues did come in at 1.54%. We budgeted $2.43 million and we're actually at $2.47 million. And again, on the expenses, we are under because of capital spending, and unfortunately for water, we're in the red here. But I do know that projects are resuming, and that in the latter half of this year, we'll see some large increases in capital spending for both water and electric. And then the final KPI on stable rates has to do with our 10-year spend on capital projects. And so for electric, we spent $86.6 million in capital projects between 2010 and June 30th of this year, and we depreciated $84.7 million. So we're very close to keeping up with depreciation on the electric side. However, on the water side, we spent about $18.7 million and only depreciated 7.8, so we're spending a lot more than we're depreciating on the water side, which, you know, last week when I was talking to Tom about this, we did talk about potentially revamping this KPI for water in the future and maybe looking at a different metric, because on the water side, they do spend a lot on unplanned capital projects, and so maybe a better metric for them would be planned capital versus unplanned. So something that we'll definitely look at as we move into the 2021 strategic plan. The next objective is manage our resource portfolio. And the definition here is optimizing between supply and demand requirements over both short and long term allows us to improve efficiency, meet regulatory requirements, and meet customer needs and expectations. And the POE is continually optimized portfolio, meeting all resource requirements at the lowest cost. And this is a target that Matthias actually just talked about in his presentation, having to do with conservation. And as he noted, we are at $16.08 per megawatt hour year to date. So we are below the $43 target. But as he did say earlier, with LED going away, we do anticipate the $16 number to continuously increase over the next biennium. And then finally, my last objective is be financially responsible, and that is manage costs to utilize assets in an efficient and effective way to ensure financial health and stability for the district. And the POE here is to maintain at least a AAA3 or AA3 rating with Moody's and achieve the objectives of the strategic plan, and then also manage expenditures within budget levels and meet revenue requirements. And so the first KPI here is to maintain our cash balance within $500,000 of budget. And to be perfectly honest, this is a year-end number, and so it's going to be very difficult to capture what our true balance is going to be at the end of the year right now with COVID. There's just so many unknowns with the, you know, lost late fee revenue, lost interest income, write-offs, deferred capital projects. I just didn't feel comfortable putting in a green, yellow, or red here. But as the year moves on and the governor, you know, becomes more clear what he's going to do with his proclamations on disconnects and if we're actually going to be able to do those at some point this year, there's just so many variables here. I just left this one unknown at this time. But some good news on the last KPI here, our cash reserves. To be green, we have to be greater than 120 days moving towards the 150-day target. And at the end of June, we're at 155 days at $22.4 million. The bad news here, though, is that June is our peak month typically for reserves. After June, our expenditures typically will outpace our revenue. And just to give an example on that first note there, last year we dropped 33 days from June to the end of the year. So we had 24.1 last June and end of the year at 19.558. However, if we do include our weatherization stabilization fund, it would bring our days cash on hand to 172. But right now this is sitting pretty positive. But we are getting into the latter half of the year where we will make up some expenditures on capital. So this number I do anticipate will decline for the rest of the year. Okay, so real quick on the arrears, I just wanted to give you a couple slides here. I know they're difficult to see, but this first one is our aging history. So this is the blue, I don't know if you can see my cursor, but on the far right side of the slide, the blue is our 90-day arrears, and the orange is the 60-day arrears. And these are a percentage of our outstanding accounts receivable. And as you can see, since the COVID pandemic began, the orange and blue are steadily upticking. And this next slide here, you can see it better on the far right-hand corner there. The gray is our 30-day, and then the orange and blue again are the 60 and 90. And just to point out, this for 60 days, we're at 2.5% of our outstanding receivables at the end of June, and 1.9% for 90 days. And they've never been that high before. And this is 100% due to the fact that we are unable to disconnect right now for non-payment. The account balances are just continuing to rise. And as Jim pointed out earlier, you know, as we head into the colder months, the bills are going to, you know, go up a lot, and this could get out of control, you know, if the governor does not allow us to continue disconnects. So where are we at? Residential-wise, and this data was as last Tuesday, July 21st, we had 160 90-day customers that were eligible for disconnect, and 161 that were 60 days late. And then the total arrears between the two was about 63,000 and 49,000. And of those customers, we do have payment plans with 23 of the 90-day customers and 33 of the 60-day customers. And those are customers that entered into an official payment plan with us. However, about 80 to 100 customers we do have arrangements with and or a guarantee from an assistance agency that's pledged on their account. And when I say arrangements, that's customers who have stated that they will pay by the end of this month, which is when the current moratorium expires. And so as we get closer to Friday, actually by next Monday, we should have a better idea if we're going to have most of those customers followed through on the arrangements or if they broke the arrangement. And then finally, commercial. We're actually looking really good. The last time I reported here, we had two grow-ups that were our largest outstanding customers. One of them paid $3,000 to clear out their 90-day balance. And the other one last week, I don't remember the exact dollar amount they paid, but they also cleared out the majority of their 90-day balance. So our 90-day balance for all commercial accounts is only $7,100. And then for 60-day, $9,700. And of those customers, four in each bucket have payment plans with us. So overall, for the business side of things, we are looking very good. And on the residential side, there is a fair amount of customers that we have not spoke with, but as we begin advertising the COVID relief funds through CARES that Doug was mentioning, I do anticipate that we'll get a fairly substantial amount of applications for that money, and it will greatly improve where we're sitting for arrears once we start dispersing that. So outside of that, I'll entertain any questions if you have them. Otherwise, I will stop sharing and let John go.
So what leverage do we have to get people to get on a payment plan or whatever? How do you approach that?
You know, we're very empathetic to our customers right now. If they tell us that they're having some sort of hardship based on COVID, we're doing our best to convince them to go on a payment plan and or make arrangements with us. But we do have some, unfortunately, that are telling us, well, I'm just not going to pay because I don't have to.
Yeah.
And on those ones, you know, we'll, unfortunately, when the governor does lift the moratorium, those will probably be the first customers that will get disconnected because they were unwilling to work with the utility.
Thank you.
With that, John, I'll turn it over to you so you can share your screen.
Okay, are you seeing my screen yet?
No. There, it's on.
Okay, I'm going to go over this pretty quick in the interest of time. This presentation is going to cover some of the strategic projects as well as the 2020 second quarter key performance indicators. And I'm going to focus on ensure reliable supply for the electric department as well as practice environmental responsibility for the electric department. Unfortunately, am I advancing now?
Yes.
Okay. Strategic projects. Engineering operations and procurement have 36 strategic projects that support all 11 of the district's strategic objectives that Doug went over. As of today, 27 projects are either complete or on schedule, but 9 projects are delayed or suspended, and what I'm referring to is the largest capital deferment, at least in recent memory, primarily due to COVID, but also other reasons. For a couple months, the mandated COVID-19 restrictions effectively cost about 2 months, 4 months of construction. And we also, in addition to that, have had unexpected labor shortage, key labor shortage, and indirect impacts due to state and federal agency limitations and constraints, including closed office and work only on critical work by those agencies. The unexpected labor vacancies include three long-interval lineman vacancies or extended limited duty, as well as two engineering professional or technician vacancies or transitions. The net effect is that one out of our five line crews have been functionally lost for what we expect to be most of the rest of the year. There's a temporary reduction of 40% in the number of designing engineering staff. The supervisors can fill in somewhat, but when you lose two out of your five designers, it does put you behind the eight ball. Okay, of the nine projects that have been delayed, in many cases postponed for as much as a year, the bulk of them are due to either the COVID mandated restrictions or the labor shortage. And I'm not going to go through all these, but the first one, Lake Sutherland, that was not related to COVID or labor. It's essentially, as we got into the design, we came across a DNR trespass and a CEPA requirement, so a portion of that project is going to be postponed for that reason. Snow Creek transmission realignment, even though we're teed up on that and ready to go, we do have a COVID-related restriction in access to the tribal area to actually do that work. We're still hoping to maybe get that done this year, but it's getting pretty late in the year to replace more than a dozen transmission poles. We also have had delays in the NPS, National Park Service, area contract. It expired late last year, but the that federal agency is responsible for the actual drafting, and they've requested it be put on hold until probably the emergency is complete. Also, as Matthias mentioned, we do expect delays in a multi-year project on the EV charging station corridor for Highway 101. And we believe that is generally a state agency limitation. They're working on more important things out of the Department of Commerce. So the big question is, why are five major capital projects deferred largely to unexpected loss of civil line and engineering personnel? And I think this is important for everyone to realize. We have what I call a labor-constrained budget. Approximately 63% of that budget is O&M, 37% is capital. And when you look at those slices, I would say that 55% of total labor, immediate labor O&M, is work that has to be done, responding to an outage, car pole accident, things that must be done in the very near future. Now, there is some deferrable O&M. Maybe we can postpone a substation inspection for a month without incurring too much risk, but it's not a whole lot of the pie. Now, when you look at the green shades, those are capital. When we have an immediate customer capital request in the form of a line extension or request for service, we have to provide that. You know, that simply has to be done or we're rejecting a customer. We also have immediate system capital, utility relocations, due to road projects, state and county, and we have to be on their schedule. We also have to replace, you know, poles and transformers when they're approaching failure or when they're overloaded. So those have to be done regardless. When you get into the deferrable capital or the deferrable O&M, in total that only amounts to about 25% of our total budget. So losing a single line crew or taking a hit in the engineering department disproportionately affects what can be deferred, and the majority of what can be deferred is capital, i.e., the projects we spoke about. So getting into the key performance indicators for ensure reliable supply without getting into the picture of excellence or definitions in the interest of time. for reliable supply, one of the KPIs has to do with RP3, or the Reliable Public Power Provider Award, that we started participating in 2014. And this is a very comprehensive deep dive by utility professionals who take a hard look under the hood, so to speak, and see how we're performing. The green, if we score 90% or better, or equivalent to RP3 platinum designation, that is a good outcome. Yellow, if we score better than 80%, which is the minimum score to be certified RP3. And then if we're below 80%, it means we failed our RP3 evaluation. And that does happen to some utilities. For our 2020 results, we actually did quite outstanding. We had 100% score on all four primary sections. And we were awarded the highest diamond score. And that's, you know, that's really important for us, and we're really proud of it. We're one of only four Washington PUDs so designated, the others being Clark, Benton, and Mason 3. When you look at all public utilities, only 1 in 25 are scored as diamond, and we've improved upon our previous scores of 90% and 97.5% in 2014 and 2017, so we've seen steady improvement in our evaluation. And we have more to come on RP3 in the future. Hopefully here in August we will give you a really good overview of what goes into that. It's really an eye-opener. Another Ensure Reliable Supply KPI is electric KPI called SAIDI. And I talked about this in an earlier presentation. SAIDI is the System Average Interruption Duration Index. In layman's term, it's minutes out per year per customer. And it's expressed as a running annual average of quarters. We look at this every quarter to see how we're performing in the trend. So if we've had fewer than 3 hours on average outage for each of our customers within the last year, we consider that a good outcome. If we go above that up to 250 minutes, we're yelling. If we go over 250, that's quite a warning. Now, if you look at the actual results, they're probably better now than they have been, at least since I've been here, and probably forever. We're at 91 minutes without major events, and the graph you see on the lower right-hand corner shows us the trend. Now, if I threw in major events, you would see much higher bars, and if you include the December 2018 storms, to give you an idea, that would have added well over 1,000 for the value of SAIDI. We generally exclude major events because when you have a major event, it's an all-hand effort, and if you can't respond, and in some major events we can't respond for hours or sometimes days, you really crank up the numbers for your SAIDI score, and it becomes, you know, very distorted. But we do have a long-term trend going on here, and we're going to reevaluate where we set these at, and we may even set them more rigorously in the future because we've made progress over the last 10 years for sure. Okay, I'm not going to go into this outage cause, but over the first two quarters, we've had 236 outage incidents. Trees and limbs account for almost 40% of the outage, equipment failure 16%, and non-PUD outages over 15%. Most of those are problems on the customer side of the meter, but we still have to respond, at least we will, until we develop AMI for an area, and we hope to save some of that response time through AMI. Now, the trees and limbs outages, as we get through the storm season late autumn, that will go up probably into the mid-40s. And then for, you may not be able to see it on your screen, I can on mine now, but we also have about 16% of the outages that are unknown. When we get out there, there's no apparent cause. Usually those causes can be divided between trees, avian that we didn't see, animals, things like that. So in reality, tree limb contacts are pushing close to 50% of outages in reality under that consideration. Okay, we also have a practice environmental responsibility KPI in the form of what we do with our environmental programs, which is not well known, but we do undergo underground storage tank inspections, Department of Ecology. We do that annually. For every one of our substations and facilities, we have to have a particular spill prevention counter control measures, SPCC for short plans. And they are very detailed. Each one of them is a volume that we have to keep current. We also look at Department of Ecology reporting and inspections for all PCB and other hazardous materials, including spill events. If a transformer goes off a pole, it can result in a report to the Department of Ecology, as well as a cleanup activity. And, of course, we have to ensure proper disposal records of all of our equipment and materials. And for every single project we do, many of them are subject to State Environmental Policy Act, or SEPA. Many of our major electrical projects certainly are, especially if we go across public lands. And we have a series of questions to ask and then processes and impacts to consider. And the actual evaluation, if we have no violations, we consider that good. If we have an investigation of a potential violation for any one of these areas, that's a concern. And if we have any designated violation, that is a no-no, and we call that red. Results for the first couple quarters, no violations or investigations, so that's a good outcome. And I think, do you have any questions? I think that's all that I have today.
Yeah, John, just one question. That SADE number, do we do any benchmarking with, and I realize you can't benchmark with East Side utilities because they don't have trees, but with comparable utilities with the tree problem, how do we stack up against them?
This is my personal opinion. Keep in mind, most Washington PUDs do not publish, at least on the western side of the county, do not publish the results. I do believe we stack up well with similar utilities in geography and terrain, Pacific PUD or Jefferson PUD, Grays Harbor PUD, and I think we compare favorably. When you do look at the eastern utilities, not so well, because they simply do not have the same tree exposure. If you took out our tree exposure, you'd be getting rid of almost half of our outages. But I will say 91 minutes per customer per year is pretty good. That may be as good as a Snohomish or even a Seattle City Light. I mean, most municipalities run between 60 minutes and 90 minutes for their outages. So our targets are relatively high compared to that. Their actual performance is reasonably well, even for a larger, more urban-like utility.
Thank you.
John, I have a question on the pie chart where you showed the different categories of outages. Does BPA, is there, when their line goes down, is that outage part of those pie chart and part of our data?
Yes. Okay. On the non-PUD outages, if you look at the 15.3% and you look at the 236, you can assume that you have close to 40 incidents. Well, let's see, 15, yeah, close to 35 to 40 incidents that were non-PUD. Of those, I believe two or three this last two quarters were BPA outages. The vast majority of the incidents are customer beyond the meter, but two or three of those outages were large BPA area outages for the West End.
Is there a way to, or is there a correlation between the SADE number and a loss of load probability?
Well, yes, there is. I mean, when you have an outage, typically you have a defined load. Now, excluding BPA outages, the vast majority of our outages are a single feeder or less, often just one customer. often 5 to 10 customer off of a fuse. Seldom beyond a feeder that opens up on reclose operations. The largest feeders we have is 1,000 customers, and we have 32,000 total customers. So you don't see much of a load reduction due to outages, unless you have a BPA outage. So then you, if we threw BPA into this, that would add several hours to our customer outages. They're excluded because of beyond our control.
Okay. One last question. Are these slides, you know, they're, you've got them here, of course, but they're not in the Bach passage. Are these going to be on the website?
I'm sure if there's a request to place these presentations on the website, run that through Doug, and generally we try to accommodate those requests.
Any reason why we shouldn't do that, Doug?
No, we can put these on. Just like any time someone requests something, we can put them on the website, sure.
Well, it'll be handy anyway for me because there's some stuff here I want to go back to eventually.
Sure.
Does anybody else have any more questions about the KPIs? If not, I have a broader question about the strategic plan itself. You know, in there, there's a chart, a process chart that shows a development and a review and implementation process based on a calendar year. Are we in the process of developing our next our 2021 strategic plan, and how's that timeline folding out?
Yeah, that's in development now. It's gone to from the direct reports. We pretty much take the last year's 2020 strategic plan, and we'd be sending that to all the departments, and they're looking at that at the same time they're looking at their budgets, because obviously the budgets and strategic plans fit together.
Okay, well, if you remember from last summer when we were looking at this strategic plan, I made some comments and we had a conversation about, you know, wow, it would be good to really drill deep into this thing a little further and look at some more externalities in terms of our strategic objectives. And given the situation with the energy market, new technologies coming on, even, you know, a year ago, everybody thought batteries were an absurd idea, frankly. And here we have 3,000 megawatts of battery storage piled up on the BPA interconnection. And so the math on that has changed dramatically. And so we've got all these emerging technologies. We've got, you know, the whole idea of building resilience here and microgrids and all that kind of stuff that's been talked about for years, more solar, that kind of thing. The issues out with the tribal area with their power situation. Have you guys, you know, done that deep dive in this thing and come up with some new ideas, you know, some stuff that's truly strategic? I mean, this is a great management plan, but that's what it mostly is. It's a management set of management indicators. So what about that?
Hey, Jim, I can speak to a couple projects, and they're very preliminary. They're evaluation of the economics for a large-scale distribution battery integrated into a low bay of our substations on the order of 5 megawatts with a benefit to offset BPA demand charges. So we've lined out costing, current costing on the latest numbers for something like that. There's also been the talk about potentially a community solar, either under CETA or the CETA low-income Section 1200. We've also done some preliminary dollars on that, as well as costing for a potential future small modular nuclear reactor. But the numbers are, you know, working numbers that we do periodically. We don't see CETA dictating that type of response for a number of years, but we're definitely looking at the dollars and the current context of what battery costs are, community solar is, as well as our future requirements.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, historically here, we're kind of a conservative small utility. We don't We don't have the deep pockets like Snohomish, Seattle, or Clark has that can spend money on wave energy technology or expensive battery programs. We kind of wait till the technology is proven, and then if the economics work out for us, we may add it to our system. We, you know, examples like GIS, OMS, SCADA, even AMI, Community Solar Project, even NISC, which I mentioned earlier, we kind of wait till they're proven before we start looking at putting it into our system, into our plans. Again, you know, we don't have big R&D budgets. We look at it, we pay attention to it, we know what's out there, but for us to start planning to add a big battery system, or I guess we could participate if there was some program like that. But we've kind of had the philosophy, which people in Jess kind of say, that we believe in being the second mouse to the cheese. We let others experiment and spend the big bucks, and we benefit from all their research and development. And once it's proven, we may go with their technology. So that's kind of historically how we looked at it. We don't have the money. We don't have the R&D effort. That's not part of our mission. So that's how it's been looked at in the past anyway, Jim.
Well, okay, a couple points. It is a strategic plan, so it's looking out quite a few years. And everything that you mentioned is you would kind of get to that level of thinking by having a strategic plan that identifies that you're going to look at some of these things. Now, granted, we're not in the R&D business or any of that kind of stuff, but we certainly should be in the business of having a strategic plan that says we are going to look at innovations, we're going to look at this, all these different things that we just talked about, and have a metric for it. In other words, it's not the metric must say by X time we're going to have X amount of solar or something. Well, there'd be nothing wrong with that, but it at least ought to say we're going to be, you know, going to go through and review emerging technologies and stuff like this that people, you know, what's out there. I mean, you know, a lot of this stuff's already been penciled out by the industry, or it wouldn't be, you know, piling up on the interconnection transmission queues. The other thing, you know, somebody gave me most of every PUD through every 3 months PUD newspaper for 20 years. And I noticed that there was a lot of innovation, you know, discussed in that thing. You know, our PUD was going to look at stuff, try stuff, you know, think about stuff. Back in the, 10 to 20 years ago, and so I would say that we at one time did have, a taste for thinking strategically. But that's what I think we ought to have in our strategic plan is more discussion about facing the future with some aggressive, you know, foresight or something.
Okay. I mean, we can certainly look at that. I mean, I would take issue that we have been looking at technology. We added AMI. We added GIS. What, 10 years ago, we didn't have a OMS system, outage management system. We didn't have a GIS system. We didn't have the NISC system. I mean, we've gone and added a lot of new technology to our systems over the last 10 years, and we'll continue to do that. We have that community solar project that we just finished up on that. We're looking at it kind of as a pilot program. We're looking at it kind of like if we can get a grant for the battery system, we'll have battery added to the system. So, I mean, we do have on our practice environmental responsibility, we do have to develop a clean energy and climate action plan. We are looking at that. Technology, guys like all our engineers and myself and John, I mean, that's been our life is the technology and the utility business. I've got 45 years. John's got 35 or more years. It's just part of the things that that we look at. It's not like we ignore it. We do continually look at it.
Well, a couple of comments. I keep hearing about this 3,000 megawatts. It seems to be implied that Bonneville is going to buy that power. They're not. They may provide transmission services for it at a cost. And you don't know what that cost is going to be. Energy Northwest did a deep dive on battery technology for Horns Rapid Solar Farm. 8 megawatts was the output of the nameplate for the solar farm, and they could only justify 1 megawatt of battery backup. In addition, California just started up the largest battery facility in the country. It's only 65 megawatts. They only have something like 400 right now, and they're going to need 4,500 to meet their zero carbon. So, you know, if battery technology was mature and cost-effective, California would be doing it. So,
well, Will, just because it's on the interconnection queue doesn't mean BPA is going to buy it.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
That's not my point. My point is that stuff wouldn't be on there if it didn't pencil out somewhere somehow.
Well, I'm not sure it's on there. I keep hearing that number. I've never seen that verified anywhere.
Well, if you Google BPA interconnection queue, you will see for yourself. There's a table, an Excel spreadsheet. I can send it to you.
Well, I guess to answer your question, Jim, we can certainly look at future technologies and investigate it. And when it does, you know, fit Clallam PUD and is economical, you know, it can be in our strategic plan to as part of a plan to look out there. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure what you're looking for. I'm sorry.
Well, I guess there's nothing in our – you know, the stuff you talked about is great, and you guys have implemented some second bite of the cheese technology approaches and so forth. But our strategic plan doesn't reflect you're doing that, and that's what I'm after is why don't we write that down, is that we do want to look out and because then recognize that there's a lot of tech changes and rapidly changing technology. There's a changing energy market in California that impacts us in ways that we're not even sure about yet. There's and then there's just the economic situation and where it's headed. That's still a wild card. And then there's just these basic ideas that you guys, I know, have talked about, resiliency and so forth, and what we can do to make our PUD better than it is. And so, but I think those ideas initially need to be reflected in the strategic plan. And I think a year ago we also talked about maybe making sure the public had more involvement in the development of the strategic plan. And so I don't know if we want to make that do a little workshop with the invited public or some group or something, or at least advertised, on the website that we're seeking input on the strategic plan.
Okay, we can look at that. I'm looking at the, and we do have a lot more KPIs to follow, which, as Will said, we can
postpone
to the future. Let me just mention, Will, though, that if I look at our resource portfolio, if you look at the actual strategic initiatives, we do have things such as evaluate cost-effective demonstration projects associated with EV charging, community solar, microgrid technologies. I mean, we do look at some of these things, plan, design, implement engineering projects that cost-effective, reduce or optimize line losses, customer conservation. I mean, we do have some of that. And I guess we'll just have to talk to you and see a little bit more what you're leaning towards.
Okay, well, why don't we cut it off there? Is this a good breaking point, Doug?
Yeah, this is good. Yeah, Tom comes next with basically his reliability, and then he goes into his other strategic objectives. So this works.
Okay, we'll give him a reprieve till next meeting. All right, our action items. Is T on? Do we have action items?
Yeah.
Well, we'll get those later.
We do not have any action items from the commissioners.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Next item is comments from the public. So, Sean, you're the gatekeeper.
You bet. If there's any public that wants to make a comment, please go ahead and give me your first name now.
Paula.
Anybody else? Okay, Paula.
I'm really here just as a League of Women Voters observer to the PUD Commission, but I did have a question about the Department of Commerce report, the spreadsheet that shows, forgive me, I'm still on a steep learning curve here, but it looks like power generation for the PUD. And the question was raised about solar and the fact that it doesn't appear on that spreadsheet. And I had been, in studying the website, I had noticed the same spreadsheet or a version of it on the website. And I'm interested that, so I want to make sure I understand that you're saying solar doesn't show up because there's not enough of it, even though that spreadsheet goes out to 2 decimal points. So you're saying basically it's not even 0.01% of Clallam energy. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, this is John Purvis, and that was not actually correct. Basically, our solar, our rooftop solar, we have well over 350, almost 370 interconnects. They're relatively small. They're supplying, the largest one is approximately 25 kW. Most of them are under 10 kW. In the summertime, they do constitute a measurable amount of load. In the afternoon, on a sunny day, it could be close to 2.5 or 3 megawatts. Now, don't take me literally. That's just going by memory, which may be incorrect, but it's in that ballpark. But those are under a net metering configuration from the BPA perspective, on which the Department of Commerce reporting relies upon. It's invisible to them because it's a local load handled within distribution outside of their purview. They don't know it's there. So we do not have any large contracts with solar farms externally or internally presently, although the solar is significant. It's just not part of our BPA awareness portfolio.
And I think I would add to that that we have more rooftop solar than any other PUD our size. So,
which leads me to my follow-up question. Do you report that in any way just for local PUD ratepayers on your website or anywhere? Could we find that information, how much solar is being generated by rooftop solar customers?
John, can you answer that one?
Yeah, it would be an estimate because right now we don't have AMI for any kind of real time, but I do utilize a rough estimate for solar in our planning study every 3 years. So we have a pretty good idea what the capacity is, the installed capacity. We also know the percentage of KW generation within a typical year, somewhat weather dependent, 12-13% of that installed capacity. So we could make that available, or we could make the planning study available that might go into some of those details. Right now, I do not believe it is currently on the website, although at Doug's discretion, we could provide some kind of information on total interconnects and designed capacity of the interconnects. Would not be too much of a challenge because we have agreements. We know what's installed, and then we could give, based on area characteristics, what that means for how much solar is produced. So it wouldn't be that much of a challenge to put it on the website as an estimate.
Thank you very much.
Sean, do we have other questions?
I had nobody else, no.
Okay, good. All right, we do not have an executive session. So is there any other business to come before the commission? If not, we're adjourned.
Thanks, Lou.